This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris and I've got with me Ibrahim Sani, 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 4th of May. Happy 4th of May. May the 4th, Ibrahim Sani.
Good morning, Melissa. Happy 4th of May and may the 4th be with you.
There you go, God. Star Wars Day. How long have you been waiting to say that to me? Of course, today is known among the fandom of Star Wars as Star Wars Day. The fans initiated the May the 4th festivities many years ago, but this not long after Disney's purchase of Lucasfilm back in 2012. They really embraced the date and turned it into more of a somewhat holiday for geeks and fans alike, but also it's a huge marketing opportunity.
Exactly. So that's something that Disney is very good at doing, making money, turning things that, you know, initially started as hobbies into money-making initiatives.
Yeah, with all the merchandise that comes with it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll be discussing more on May the 4th a little later in the show. But first, let me tell you what's coming up this morning. Just a couple of shows to highlight to you. On The Breakfast Grill, Sharad Kutan will be speaking to Wong Hien Fine, the group CEO of Surbana Jurong.
Of course, Surbana Jurong is a Singaporean company. It's an engineering firm and they are experienced in urban planning as well. A lot of the development in Singapore is credited towards Surbana Jurong's efforts and initiatives. Of course, we have that HDB flats, we have that HDB initiatives, but Surbana Jurong actually created much of the urban planning aspect of that development. So now they are tasked with helping cities around the world. I think one can argue that Singapore is saturated in terms of urban planning, but of course you know a lot more can be done in Singapore, but Surbana Jurong is taking up the mantle of exporting their expertise.
You know, whatever we may think about Singapore, our personal opinions about Singapore, you can't deny that they got the urban planning right.
Yeah,
I mean, if you go to Singapore, they got it right with the huge the big pedestrian walkways, and you know it's really well thought out.
Yeah, exactly, and the mix of green and building as well.
So for such a developed city, there's a lot of green in the city center.
So I had the opportunity to spend much of my university days in Singapore as well, because of some of the work that I do back when I was doing my undergraduate. And you know, I spent campus hopping, right, from NTU to SMU to NUS. They're all green campuses, really green campuses, and that really takes me by surprise, because you know, you don't have an afterthought to make a green building. You actually imbue it initially when you had that blueprint hatched.
You have to have it from the very beginning, right? And it's quite, it always surprises me, because I always think of Singapore as a place with land constraints. For them to have incorporated so much green and so much open space, which is something I feel is quite lacking in our urban planning. And the thing is, Surbana Jurong is now helping cities around the world with their expertise, with the with urban planning, including Penang. So Penang is, I believe Penang has approached Surbana Jurong for some help with their affordable housing program, housing.
Now, even in yesteryears, Penang and Singapore has always had that, similarity.
The Straits.
The Straits settlements, using the same currency, the Straits dollar, and being the port of call for many merchants and traders. And one must not forget that Penang has a bustling port business and industry. So there's a lot of similarities between Singapore and Penang.
Also land constraints.
Yeah, right? Land constraints. And of course, I think that they're doing land reclamation as well in the southern part of Penang, at least. And I think, it's hand in glove, I suppose, for Surbana Jurong to assist Penang.
Well, let's find out more with the CEO of Surbana Jurong, Wong Hien Fine, on The Breakfast Grill today, 8 a.m. And after the grill on current affairs, we speak to Professor James Chin. He is the director of the Asia Institute at the University of Tasmania in Australia. Now, he's back in Malaysia as an independent observer in the Sarawak state elections. So we're going to be asking him what's happening on the ground there, What is he seeing?
Perhaps he's even Penang as you...
It could be.
But, so this is part of the continuation of the dialogue that we're having on the Sarawak state elections. The rundown to the election is a bit interesting because it's becoming clear that the state government is blocking any initiative of the opposition on campaigning. I've even seen banners and posters put up by the ruling coalition saying that if you're from the members of the opposition, you're not supposed to even enter some villages. And that is something that is quite disturbing if you think about it on one hand. But on the other hand, you could imagine the kind of stronghold that Barisan Nasional has on Sarawak. So for Professor James Chin to actually have a chat with us and ask what's happening there on the ground, that would be fantastic because he is on the ground there in Sarawak.
Yeah, as an independent observer, he's kind of looking at whether it's a level playing field, whether everyone's abiding by the rules. And we'll just check in with him later today at 8:35 a.m. For what's happening with the Sarawak state elections. Okay, at 9:35, we have the S&M show today, as we do every Wednesday. We're going to be looking at EPF's 2015 annual report, which came out yesterday. We look at very specific aspects of EPF's investment process and the outsourcing of fund management to external fund managers. The question we're asking this morning, are they worth it?
Yeah, so this is also another part of our continued discussion on EPF's annual report. Melissa, I remember we did this 2014 annual report
2 weeks ago,
on SNM. You can
that
catch
was
that.
Because 2015 wasn't out yet, right?
Yeah. But we sort of like had that whiff of rumor that it's going to be announced. So I guess it's good to compare what 2014 had for us versus what 2015 was presented to us yesterday. One thing that we need to note is that it was a good year for EPF, considering all things equal. It wasn't a good year in general for equities and also the bond markets for 2015. But EPF managed to weather that storm. I think the clear difference here is that EPF's returns could have been bigger if the sectors of oil and gas and also the banking industry could be well or better cushioned. Mm. But having said that, even though oil and gas and the banking industry took a blow for EPF's investment, overall, the portfolio level, I think EPF did extremely well.
Yeah. Okay, so today we're, I think, going to be looking at some of how EPF invests. And I think a couple of weeks ago, we looked at how they did that for 2014. And in a way, how they invest makes you, it's also a reflection of how you invest because they're investing your money for you. So in a small way, the investor that EPF is also the investor that we are.
And that's exactly why it's important for us to actually understand what's happening with EPF's thought process in investment. And, you know, a lot of things have happened over the course of at least a few months. One of them is the 1MDB scandal. It continues to unfold. And we had that major discussion just 3 or 4 weeks ago on the potential of a cross default of 1MDB. Uh-huh. So Dato' Shahril, the CEO of EPF, said that it's not going to affect EPF's overall investment because their exposure is limited. So I think these kind of assurance coming in from EPF allows individuals to actually take comfort into how and what EPF does with our money. It's actually our money.
Our money, yeah, exactly. EPF on the S&M show today, 9:35 a.m. Don't miss that. 9 minutes past 6 o'clock. Let's take a quick look at the news roundup from yesterday. One of the biggest issues in Sarawak at the moment is the case of Ronnie Rebbit. Now, the National Registration Department has confirmed that it is withdrawing its appeal in the case of Ronnie Rebbit, who is a Sarawakian Muslim convert who recently won a court ruling to be legally recognized as a Christian.
So the background to this is that the Kuching High Court had last month ordered the NRD to issue Ronnie Rebbit an IC with the name that he was born with and to remove the Muslim classification. This is a landmark ruling that his conversion as a minor was not of his own volition and that he was compelled to actually embrace Islam and therefore he had the constitutional right to freedom of religion.
You know, it's funny because here in, I guess here in the peninsula, we're kind of, there's somewhat of a you know, a big gap between the news that makes, you know, that makes headlines here and the news that makes headlines in East Malaysia. This story is really big in Sabah and Sarawak. People are really talking about this. His case, he's basically, his name is on everybody's lips. It's seen as a huge, I think, a precedent that this has happened, and that a lot of people are quite happy that the NRD has decided to drop this appeal. It was, I guess, the approach in Sabah and Sarawak for, you know, conversion cases and cases. This Rodney was converted as a child, as a minor, and the court found him, you know, he was unaware of his circumstances at that time. So I think this was a really good move on the NRD's part in terms of popularity, on the government's part in terms of popularity. But whether this is a one-off case, whether it will have any traction, remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think this is indeed one of those landmark cases. You know, the very notion of why we classify a child is because the child can't give consent.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere between asking what the child wants for dinner versus all the way to say, you know, what religion that child has to embrace. I think the very reason why we have the Child Act, and it was very new, the creation of that act, is to allow for the better classification of what a child can and cannot do. One of them is choosing religion. I think it's very clear that a child can't be left to choose his religion, and to compel the child to do so is unconstitutional.
I think one of the biggest points that I forgot to mention here is that there was an intervention by Adnan Satim and the Prime Minister. So that, in fact, was, I think, seen as a very popular move by the campaigning parties there. I've seen opposition members come out to say, okay, good move, we'll give you a pat on the back for that, but let's not make this the only case because there are other pending cases in court. Clearly, you know, all parties campaigning recognise that this was a really hot issue in Sarawak at the moment, and they in a strove to win the brownie points, shall we say.
Yeah, you know, the benefactors of a campaign period, it's not just people like Rune Rabbit and the likes. It's actually people like you and me, because if you can see, the oil prices actually went up, you know, over the past month, and all of us actually were expecting May 1st to see some sort of price hike, and that hike never happened. And my neighbour was telling me, well, it's election season, so, you know, enjoy it while it lasts.
Okay. All right. In other news, over in Brazil, the WhatsApp messaging service has now been resumed. This was after an appeals court overturned a suspension, and many of the application's 100 million users in the country voiced outrage. Again, this is the voice of the people overturning a court decision. So what happened was WhatsApp was cut off on a judge's order because they were talking about how they had requested information from Facebook regarding a drug trafficking ring, but Facebook failed to comply with that order, and the judge said to cut off WhatsApp.
Yeah, you know,
I can imagine why people would get mad, to be honest.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes I just want to check, you know, where my kid is on WhatsApp. Right? It's not about changing governments or revolutions.
Yeah, but I mean this.
Yeah.
I don't know, how dangerous is it that WhatsApp and Facebook have become so intertwined in our daily lives we will forever support these tech giants because we're so dependent on them.
No, but I think the government is missing the plot. It's about ways of communication. Now, if you block, you know, WhatsApp, there's still going to be means to communicate with other people. You can't ban the entire form of communication.
So what they were trying to do, what the courts were trying to do, was to punish Facebook for not sharing that data. Facebook owns WhatsApp, right?
Yeah.
So to punish Facebook for not complying with that court order, they needed the information to chase a criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. So where do you fall on this? Do you think that the judge was right to do so, or do you think Facebook was right not to comply?
I think Facebook was right not to comply because my personal data is at the mercy of Facebook and WhatsApp. And if, you know, companies like Facebook and WhatsApp willingly gives information, we know our government willingly gives information.
But what about if it's a court order? I mean, this is similar to
the Apple
and FBI case, right?
Argument. Yeah. That's right. But, you know, I just just watched the entire Facebook announcement, the financials announcement that was that happened about a week ago or maybe 2 weeks ago. And one thing interesting is that Mark Zuckerberg says that there's 1 billion WhatsApp users monthly. And if it's true that, you know, Brazil has 100 million users in Brazil alone, that means Brazil accounts for 10% of the WhatsApp users. And I think that comes to a point where does Brazil stand in terms of regulating information with its people? Because, like I said, just because Facebook doesn't comply, you don't punish the consumers. What next? Are you going to punish Microsoft? Are you going to punish Apple and so on? It doesn't make sense in terms of trying to get what they want from these tech companies.
BFM 89.9, that was the Who I Can See for Miles. Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Ibrahim Sani here with me, 6:21 on Wednesday, May the 4th. Be with you.
May the fault be with you.
I'm going to keep saying that a whole morning. Bear with me. A story we're looking at this morning is a debate that's happening on the New York Times. Now, we're going to bring it here because it's quite an interesting debate that I think Malaysians can also benefit from. So in the US, most states have banned texting while driving, but distracted driving only seems to be getting worse. So in New York, legislators have introduced a bill that will allow police officers arriving at the scene of a crash to test drivers' phones for evidence of recent activity with a device they call the Textalyzer. That's the digital equivalent of the Breathalyzer. So the question is this the best way to deal with the public consequences of texting and driving? And what else can be done to stop people from doing this?
If you remember that TV show, Mad Men, it was set in the 1960s, and there was this one episode where cops were actually trying out a new law, and it's called the Breathalyzer. And in that show, it just falls back to that whole notion of how outraged the society was at that particular time. How can law enforcement... and remember, this is the land of the free and the home of the brave, where you can carry arms to defend yourself against the government, by the way, yeah? So how can a government official, in this sense, the policeman, can test my breath? They had to just take my word for it. But, 50 years, 60 years down the road, we realize that it's not only important for the police officers to do so, it's for the public good.
Public safety would feel
safer if I know that the cops are testing drivers out there for whether or not that person is on alcohol or otherwise.
Okay. All right. So for me, there are two questions here. First of all, is texting and driving as bad as drunk driving? And the other thing is, if we know it's bad, why do we still do it? I mean, so many campaigns, I don't know whether you've seen these campaigns, but the campaign, It Can Wait, you know, when your phone buzzes, but the campaign is to like, don't check it, it can wait. Nothing is more important than your safety, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know about you, but I do it too. I'm guilty of checking my phone while I'm driving. Often I'm stuck in traffic and I'm checking my phone or I'm replying emails or whatever, and I don't put it down as the car starts rolling forward, as the traffic starts to move. I don't know whether that's been the case for you, and I'm guilty of this. I'm admitting it publicly on live radio.
It's true. I think it's hypocritical if anyone doesn't say that they don't do it, because
there are people who who don't. And, you know, Sharad Kutin has, every time I drive Sharad and I do it, he tells me to put my phone away.
Yeah.
I know he just tells me, oh, you shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
And it's good. That's what passengers are supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
But many of us still
light,
do
for
it.
Instance, the traffic light is sorted in three colors. Green, orange, and Facebook.
That's terrible. We're not condoning this.
If you're listening to us out there, I mean...
Put your phone down.
Put your phone down.
Listen to the radio.
Yeah. This talks about addiction, right? And addiction doesn't mean that you're addicted to cigarette or you're addicted to alcohol. It's just addiction outright.
It's not addiction, though. It's really... I don't know what it is. It's a bad habit. I reach for my phone when I'm stalled at a light.
No, you would call it a bad habit. I would call it an addiction. I'm addicted to my phone. When I was, back in my smoking days, I have to grab my first cigarette within the first 30 minutes of waking up.
Wow.
And that is a cigarette addiction. For my phone, I don't even have to wait for 30 minutes. I actually, the moment I wake up, I grab my phone. And I don't think that's healthy.
So we admitted publicly on air that we both are guilty of this. What do you think it'll take to get people to change this habit? I mean, it took years of campaigning and public education to stop people from drinking and getting behind the wheel. What would it take to stop us from using our phones behind the wheel? And on the flip side, do you think it is as dangerous as being intoxicated on alcohol and driving?
Yeah, critical question. I don't think so.
Okay, so distracted driving is not as bad as drunk driving.
Yeah, because everybody uses GPS. Cabbies, drivers, you and me, we all use GPS.
But they're not holding their phones, though.
It's not about holding or not holding, because when you drive a stick, you only have one hand on the wheel anyway. It's about the concept of distracting. There's always another screen that you have to refer to take the left turn or right turn.
Okay.
Turn by turn navigation system in Malaysia doesn't work because we don't understand what the machine is trying to say, with Malay named roads, for instance. So we still have to refer to it, while looking at our screens.
So I remember that there was also a campaign many years ago in, I can't remember which country it was, that was discouraging people from eating and driving.
Yeah, I remember that?
Yes. Because that is also considered distracted driving. This was before the age of smartphones,
yeah,
right?
But so even in Malaysia, our lawmakers were actually debating on that. It was the early 2000s, before the age of the digital, lawmakers were actually trying to ponder whether or not it's feasible to ban people from eating while driving.
Right.
But of course, that never saw the light of day.
Yeah, I mean, we drive through all the time and have one hand on the burger, another hand on the steering wheel. So is that the same as, one hand frantically typing a message to say I'm on the way and the other hand trying to indicate and make that turn? And
yeah. And so the very notion that the New York legislatures actually have done this, this taxalizer, it's because I think this is what they think would be the best way to deal with public health consequences.
How does the taxalizer work, actually?
Okay. Yeah, so the taxalizer works in a way where the cops will just, and I'm reading of the article actually,
mm-hmm.
The cops will pull you to the by the side of the road and will use a device or an ability for them to actually open your phone and actually check your behavior within, say, the last 5 minutes of your phone. And that taxalizer is actually going to be able to tell whether or not you actually, you were on your social site.
Basically, if there's been any activity in the minutes leading up to a crash, so they can check whether you've actually used your phone. Because in New York, you're not even allowed to touch your phone. It's hands-free driving. Hands-free driving laws. So I guess in that sense, that's quite interesting. But I'm sure there are ways for us to change the mindset of people to put their phones down. How can we drill it in our heads that that call or that text or that email can wait till you've parked safely, especially if you've got kids in the car.
Again, I think it's not bad habit. I think it's more of an addiction. And I think this is where we are so hooked up to our phones that we really need to reassess our lives again. Really, it's like walking around with a tool, right? Yeah.
Okay, we've got the first news bulletin coming up at 6:30 with Natalie Sia on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Lenny Kravitz there with American Woman. Maybe one day he'll write a song about me, the Malaysian woman.
Ah, there you go.
Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Ibrahim Sani here with me. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9.
Hang on, may the fourth be with you, Melissa.
May the fourth be with you, Ibrahim
Sani.
It's
like one of those chants, that incantation that you just say over
okay,
and over again.
Okay, all right.
Again.
So when did you start saying may the fourth be with you?
I think a few years ago, actually. You see, I was late to the game.
Me too.
Yeah, me growing up, Chelsea was on my mind most of the time, not so much Star Wars. But having three kids, you have to be sucked into this whole universe. And I started enjoying watching Star Wars only after, you know, I had my kids.
Okay, well, you know, I only started saying May the 4th be with you. In fact, it completely, I never realized that that was what May the 4th was. I only started saying it last year, to be completely honest with you. Yeah. I'm quite bad at things, at pop culture.
I think
The Office is full of geeks, so that helps. Yeah. And BFM is full of Star Wars fans.
I've never worked in an organization that had this much geeks around. But
the geekdom is strong here. The force is strong here in BFM. Okay, so fans initiated the May the 4th festivities several years ago, but I think Disney really capitalized on this date after they bought Lucasfilms, and they turned it into a kind of secular holiday for geeks, but also they really milked it for the ripe marketing opportunity that it was. And I guess it's really kind of timely to take a look at why the Star Wars franchise is so valuable. If you think about it, Star Wars... Everybody has something to like about Star Wars. Your dad, you in your generation, and your kids. Yeah. So, I mean, your dad could like the original Star Wars. You could have grown up with it. And then now your kids could be really into the trilogy, the new trilogy that's come out.
Yeah.
So clearly there's a marketing opportunity at every generational level here.
Yes, and when you think about how pervasive this Star Wars notion is, a lot of these know-how or learn-all websites, for instance, they even list down the things that you need to know about the Star Wars franchise. A very popular website that many of us in the financial sector like to go to is Investopedia.
Mm-hmm.
And we get jargons, we get financial jargons on it. Concepts are being taught there. And right now, they also carry the Star Wars universe franchise. So Investopedia is now explaining to us why Star Wars franchise is so valuable.
You know why? Because you marry the pop culture elements of Star Wars with the money-spinning marketing spiel that it is. You know, the ability for you to spin merchandise from this. You can think of how, I mean, you're talking about T-shirts and toys and collectibles and theme parks. I mean, we've seen this happen with almost every big kind of franchise. The Harry Potter franchise, for instance, comes nowhere close to what Star Wars is. But in terms of merchandising, they've got the right idea.
Yeah, they got the right idea. And that's why they created new and new toys about, like, for instance, the BB-8 droid. It wasn't necessary for
them
to create.
That's kind of cute, though, I have to say.
Yeah, they're rebooting it, right? It's a 2016 version of, say, the R2-D2 droid. But I think this taps into that bigger picture where we try to seek relevance and similarities of a fantasy world with our world. I remember watching very clearly a YouTube video explaining the economies and the economics of, say, Westeros in Game of Thrones.
Uh-huh.
And they try to see, you know, what kind of business it does, the feudal system, how does it support the local economy and so on. And it was a very good YouTube video. And I think it's also relevant for us to talk about this as well, because the Star Wars franchise is so valuable because it does touch on various issue. One of them is the demographic ability. So you're right, Melissa. It has something for everyone, generational length.
You know, I just want to touch back. You said you were talking about the economy of Westeros, right?
Yeah.
There's also the economy of the Galactic Empire. So if you think about how the Galactic Empire is being run, what kind of economy it is, apparently the Star Wars creator George Lucas said that he had incorporated some thematic elements from Nazi Germany into his vision of the Galactic Empire. And I think it's quite interesting to see the comparison of both, because both the Galactic Empire and Nazi Germany came into being on the back of an economic crisis.
Yeah, it makes sense, because if you think about it, that economic crisis that you're referring to, Melissa, was the fact that Germany was reeling from its loss in World War One. It was brought to its knees by its fellow neighboring countries and the United States.
Mm.
And Nazi Germany was characterized by the readiness to go to war.
Exactly. What is the Death Star if not a weapon of mass destruction ready on the the brink of war.
Planetary destruction, actually.
There
yes.
you go, there you go. So those are just some of the comparisons between, you know, the economy of the Galactic Empire and Nazi Germany. But very quickly, let's take a look at the merchandising of Star Wars. Disney is brilliant at this. You look at what they did with the Marvel series. Look yeah. at how they did Frozen. I don't know about you, but I'm sure your kids must be
yes.
still into Frozen
they
merchandise.
They are still there into Frozen. I mean, you know, but I don't buy that, you know, $300 dress. I actually buy that 10 ringgit, you know, right in front of Giant or Tesco, that kind of
replicas.
Thing. There you go. and this obviously shows that Disney is smart in terms of monetizing their profits. It goes far beyond the box office. The key advantage that underlies many movie franchises is their ability to do merchandising, and that merchandising has to have a sustainable experience. Not a one-off thing, but a sustainable experience.
So, for instance, with the movies that they will roll out every year, if I'm not mistaken, the ticket sales from that is only a certain portion of revenue, right? We're talking about year-long sales when it comes to merchandising, and there will be people who will buy them. There will be collectors, there will be birthdays and Christmases where you will opt for a Star Wars-themed something or another, right?
Yeah, and it's the ability to actually syndicate this merchandising licenses to other franchisees. That is important as well. So while they gain from the direct sale of, say, Lego sets and water bottles and keychains and phone cases, they can actually outsource that license to, say, McDonald's and other franchises.
I have to ask you, do you have any Star Wars merchandise?
I do, actually. And it wasn't by...
Even though you're not like a mega fan, you still
have... I didn't buy it.
Okay.
So, I applied for a credit card and from a bank in Malaysia. And the guy said, if you sign up for a credit card, you can either have a luggage or a set of, say, you know, Star Wars figurines.
And you opted for the
Star Wars figurines because I got it for my kids. I don't buy it for myself.
Oh, you're a good dad.
And this is exactly what I'm talking about. They can partner up with almost anyone and anything to cross-sell their product.
Does it ever get on your nerves? I don't know about you, but in the lead-up to the rollout of The Force Awakens, everything was Star Wars themed.
Yeah.
I actually saw Star Wars themed breakfast cereal and something else. I can't remember, was it soap? Star
really?
Wars themed soap?
Yeah. Okay, so...
Wash the force off you.
This is why I get very, very upset quite easily, you know, and I get very, angry
in some areas.
It feels
like we've been taken for a bit of a ride, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I do feel that in that sense, but... It's only natural for companies to jump on the marketing bandwagon.
I can't remember for the longest of time a movie that I've watched multiple times. This year, I've done it twice already. One of them is Star Wars because, you know, back to my kids.
The kids.
They forced me over and over again to watch these movies again.
Children
and again.
Are the best consumers.
And the other one... and that's why they had a ban on advertising to kids, right? During
right.
their prime time Saturday and Sunday,
that's
you can't
right.
actually advertise fast food because of fear that you know, you might influence children to make that purchase on fast food outlets. But anyway, the second time that I had to watch a movie over and over again is actually this new movie by Marvel,
The Captain America.
Captain America, uh-huh. Civil War. And you know, you see, so the difference here is that Civil War, it's very much restricted to, say, the box office. You don't see them, you know, going into that merchandising world.
There are some, though. I mean, I walked past Toys R Us too, on my way to the movie theaters,
yeah.
and it was just filled with Marvel toys, so merchandising.
Not another. So I guess we can't really escape ourselves.
Yeah,
from this.
I think the movie studios will definitely capitalize on any opportunity to merchandise their movies, right? And if we have a money spinner like the Marvel series and the Star Wars series, why not? Why not rake in the big bucks? 6:49, coming on to 6:50 right now, and we'll be back with more at the top of the hour on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.